Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. This episode of Kimberly's Intentional Moment is brought to you by the Seika Network on Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and good morning. This is Kimberly Knaus, and this is Kim Talk Radio, or Kimberly's Intentional Moment. I am so excited today to introduce and welcome my teacher and my friend, Salvatore Zambito, to the show. I met Salvatore because I had to do a Yoga Sutras class for yoga teacher training, and because I preferred one-on-one rather than the classroom, and like many Westerners, I wanted some physical practice, I didn't want to just sit and listen. And so it was uncomfortable for me. What happened next surprised me, and it shifted my thinking forever. When a true teacher speaks, he or she is not just conveying information, but is transmitting or has a transmission of a deeper state of consciousness. The fact that he is silly, gregarious, and fun, and at the same time honest, even when it's hard for me or others to hear, you can create a life bond, or we have created a life bond, beyond what I ever thought possible, and I am so fortunate to be a part of it. Before we talk to Salvatore, I want to introduce his two reference works, two works of yoga, The Unadorned Thread of Yoga, and the Yoga Sutras Sanskrit English Dictionary. And if you have any questions, and I will repeat this later at the end of the show, you can contact him at salvatore@yogasutras.net. So, having said that, Salvatore, when did you begin your yoga journey, and who were your main guides?
Thank you, Kimberly. It's always a pleasure to be with you. My first formal yoga class I attended in 1967 in Chicago at the Shivananda Yoga Center, and my teacher was a woman named Margaret Yeoman. But something that is a little bit different then than now was that if you were going to study yoga in the 60s and 70s and earlier, you were going to be working directly with the Indian authorities or the first generation of their students. So the teacher I was working with was Swami Vishnu Devananda, and Margaret was his student. So I worked both with him and with her. When Swami would come to town, I would drive him around Chicago. I would be his asana model. As he was giving a lecture, I would perform the asanas that he was talking about. But the benefit for me was that driving him around, I got to have personal conversations with a man who in time became acknowledged as quite a yoga master. As the years have gone by, at this point in time, we're probably on the seventh or eighth generation of Western students of these Indian authorities. And frankly, there's been some loss and a narrowing down of the teachings through those years. When I was studying with the Shivananda, there were three things that we had to do for our yoga practice. The first was asana pranayama. The second was meditation. And the third was vegetarian diet. It was understood that asana pranayama was for the support of meditation. And we only learned and taught 12 asanas and two pranayama, and this led to meditation, which was understood that it was all preparatory for the meditative state.
Thanks, Salvatore. I just want to let the listeners know out there that we are having some technical difficulties, and so if it seems as though that intro was a little, we were skipping over it or fumbling over it, that was why. Thank you so much, Salvatore. So one of the things that I think a lot of our listeners would like to know, and I certainly would like to hear it again from you, is why are there so many translations of the Yoga Sutra into English, and how many are there?
I think it's a really good and valid question. What I'd like to do first for some of your listeners is tell you what the Yoga Sutra is. It's easy to jump to an assumption here. I think it's useful to remember that yoga had its origins in India, and it's a 5,000-year-old written tradition. India is a culture with 5,000 years of literacy, 2.5 times Western civilization in terms of age. One of the characteristics of India was that it was very non-material. This region, we now call India and Pakistan, used to be 1,500 little nations that now politically are two entities. So what we talk about India now is a very different situation from India 5,000 years ago. In fact, I'm going to, and I'm digressing, but there's a reason for this. The very name India came from Alexander the Macedonian, sometimes called Alexander the Great. The Macedonian army swept from Greece, across Turkey, across the lands we now call Afghanistan, and got in Persia or Iran, and got into India, almost to the Ganges. When they got to a river called the Sindhu, the Greeks were unable to say the Sanskrit Shah. And so they took it off the front and put it on the back and made it into the Indus. From this Greek mispronunciation of the river Sindhu, we have India. Now, if you live in India long enough that Indians regard you as a local, they don't use the word India anymore. They use their name for India, which is Bharat. And this means the land of the learned. So anytime we're dealing with India, we're very wise to assume we know nothing and that most of what we think we know is wrong. So going back to your question about the Yoga Sutra, one of the characteristics of this region we call India or Bharat was a lack of interest in technology. The Indian, this Bharat, was one of the few areas in the world that never invented the wheel. The people of Bharat on one side took the wheel from Burma, and on the other side took the Persian wheel from the Persians. They didn't need to. However, there were some characteristics here that are utterly unique. For example, the concept of zero, the mathematical concept of zero, was Indian. This has absolutely created the possibility of mathematics as we know it. The number system that we use in the West is called the Arabic numerals. That's because the West got them from the Arab traders. But the Arab traders got them from India. When they traded with India, they found this numbering system, and this numbering system was perfect for bookkeeping. But then, let's remember, the Arabs took the zero and created something that we call algebra. But they called it algebra. So take the AL, put a hyphen in it, and you've got algebra, which was an Arab contribution to the world based on the understanding of zero. The Indians also created chess. They created a musical system that had 60 scales, including one set of scales that's theoretical, and over 110 musical instruments. So they had a completely different approach to the physical world than the rest of the people. Now, this is where it comes to mean something for yoga. because of the focus that they had on the life of the mind, they developed a very broad system of philosophical inquiry. Every area of Western philosophy was investigated in India to the point of total exhaustion 1,000 years before Western civilization even emerged. Now, what happened in that time was that the many schools of philosophy, like we have in the West, became distilled to the point that they had one school of six schools. This is called the Shad Darshana. Shad means six. Darshana means viewpoints. So their six schools of orthodox philosophy were more correctly called, what we call philosophy, the six viewpoints. One of those six viewpoints was yoga. Now, yoga had a few functions here, and I'm not going to give you all of them, but one of them was that it roughly held the position of psychology in the Western world. But their understanding of psychology included the sense of an internal self, which is very different from most of the West. So what we had called transpersonal psychology was kind of a foundation of their understanding. And from this came a school of philosophy known as the Yoga Darshana. There are many schools within this. Now, each of the darshana, each of the viewpoints, had a great sage who organized and created a central textbook. The Yoga Darshana had a textbook called the Yoga Sutra, written by the great sage Patanjali. A sutra. Sutra means thread, and the English word suture comes from sutra. So the idea of a book called a sutra is that we take areas of knowledge and distill it. So a single short statement will be a sutra. But if we take an entire book of them, then the book itself is called a sutra. The Yoga Sutra of Patanjali has 196 short statements. All of them together are supposed to, and I think it does this, creates a distillation of the field under study. So when it's in the title of a book, the word sutra means a single thread unadorned by a single bead. It tells us that no word can be taken away and no more word is needed. It has been brought to its purest distillation. Now all sutras, all the books for all of the darshana are written in a language of Sanskrit. The Yoga Sutra, so far as I can tell, has been translated into English at least 103 times. And the reason for this is that certain key concepts in yoga simply don't exist in English. Therefore, there's no vocabulary for it. Also, the sutra system has a unique grammatical structure, which we don't have. The entire Yoga Sutra, 196 statements, has 4 verbs and 28 participles. So all of the rest of them are written like mathematical formula that do not involve tense and they don't involve person. And there's really no English form that goes outside of tense and goes outside of person. If we bear this in mind, perhaps we can bridge to a world that saw reality in a very different way.
Thank you so much, Salvador. I was going to ask you whether we call this the Yoga Sutras or the Yoga Sutra.
Both are correct. I tend to use, when I'm speaking of the book, I tend to talk of the Yoga Sutra, but it's composed of Yoga Sutras. No need to overthink this.
Thank you so much, because we do that a lot. Something that you have talked to me or I've heard you say more than once is that, or to go fast, or something that you recommend is for us to go fast by going slow. Can you explain that?
Oh, yes. This is one of my obsessions. We want fast food. We want fast effects. One of our American conditionings, which is almost a pathology, is a desire for instantaneous mastery. And the story of the tortoise and the hare is not a joke. This is a really powerful and important parable. And so if you come to a place of of studying the Indian tradition, the ancient masters might have disciples that they would give one or two breathing exercises and one or two movements that would be a lifetime of practice. When I was teaching yoga and stress management at Boise State University, in one semester, I had a couple of really interesting students. One of them was a little milkmaid from Bliss, Idaho, who was...
What year was this?
Oh, this would be 1981 or 1982. And she was a ballerina, had incredible flexibility. And next to her on the mat in the wrestling room was a wrestler. And wrestlers have a lot of flexibility, too, but not as much as this girl did. And I think this young man had a little bit of a crush on the milkmaid. And he was pushing himself a little bit, which is not what I recommend, but young people were in a hurry. And so he did a head-knee pose one day and was trying to bring his nose to his knees like she could, and in the process tore a hamstring.
Ow.
He was a very strong and determined young man. It's not actually easy to do that. So I actually had a certain amount of admiration for that. But the net effect was that it took him much longer to eventually do a deeper head-knee pose because he had to add recovery time to ordinary growth. So I recommend in all areas, physical, emotional, relationship, mental, go fast by going slow. Give yourself time to learn and to integrate and to apply.
Thank you. You know, one of the things that I tell my student is it's better for us to take the time that we need in order to stay present in a posture or in asana, and I want to get to that in a minute with you, rather than being set back by being injured, and now we're laying on the couch and we're recovering, and just like you said with your with the wrestler. And I would like to talk to you a little bit about that. So what is the difference between Hatha yoga and Raja yoga? Or actually, I think some of my listeners would like to know, what's the difference between Hatha yoga and asana?
Well, if you go back to some of the earlier points I was making, there are many schools of yoga. And the one that is best known in the West is Hatha yoga. And I might point out right here the pronunciation. It's not Hatha yoga, it's Hatha yoga. There is no tha sound in Sanskrit. And if it's properly written, it would be H-A underdotted T, H-A, which would give you the reference to the correct Sanskrit letter and pronunciation. So it's Hatha yoga. And Hatha yoga is composed of three main areas, asana, pranayam, the mulas and the bandhas, and the kriyas. So actually it's more than three. The word asana comes originally from the root as, which means to sit. So the difference, the core difference between Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga is that the core of Raja Yoga is meditation, while the core of Hatha Yoga, they can have a couple of goals, but one of the main goals is asana, to prepare the body for sitting. Now, this comes from the word as. This is a long A, the A with a long mark over it, A, S, as. It means in Sanskrit, it's the verb root to sit or to apply oneself. So the asana in the Yoga Sutra, which is the handbook of Raja Yoga, is speaking to the sitting practices. In Hatha Yoga, the asanas, sometimes called postures or poses, this is not linguistically quite as precise. But if you read the first two verses of the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, which is the handbook of Hatha Yoga, the first two verses make it clear that the Hatha Yoga Pradipika and Hatha Yoga are preparatory for Raja Yoga, which is to say, preparatory for the sitting practices. So we have to get our joints loose so that we can sit, but we also have to have the spine, the hips, the head, everything has to be aligned so that we can sit comfortably for 20 minutes. The respiratory capsule has to be balanced and expanded so that we can sit. You can't sit in a straight posture if your breath is constrained. And the mind cannot be brought to a single point if the breathing is random. So the entirety of Hatha Yoga can be seen in one of its branches as preparing the body for sitting practices, and in this way, the two work together. So they aren't really, they're distinct from each other, they contribute to each other. I don't like to think of them as separate. The problem here is, in the Western world, is that the term asana has come to be synonymous with yoga. In the year 2000, I wanted to reconnect with a Swami I hadn't seen for 18 years. And I found that he was giving a talk. And I attended that talk. And it was in a beautiful lecture hall. And he was up on a stage. And when the talk was done, I joined his disciples in a line at the stairs so that we could give him the Anjali Mudra, which is the hands together, the hands in prayer called Anjali Mudra. And I was about the fifth or sixth in line. As he came down the steps, he saw me, made eye contact, walked past the five or six people, came to me, put his hands on either side of me. And remember, I hadn't seen him for 18 years, Kimberly. And what he said was, I have a job for you if you want to do it. No, hi, how are you? No small talk. You know, I've got work for you. And I said, I'll do it if I can, Swamiji. He said, an urgent situation is emerging in the Western world. The terms yoga and asana are becoming synonymous. As you know very well, asana is part of yoga, but yoga is much more than asana. I am deputizing you in your teaching to specifically uncouple the manner in which these have become synonymous and bring people to an understanding of the larger field. He said the Himalayan Swamis would not have believed even 10 years ago that it was possible for the definition of yoga to become distorted in the collective consciousness. Now we see that the power of the Western media is such that such a confusion is actually possible, even imminent. So I'm asking you to do your part and deputize others. And so I'm deputizing you, as I've done before, Kimberly.
I take that very seriously.
Thank you. To bring a clarification to this, asana is important in the Hatha Yoga tradition, but it's not yoga itself. And it ultimately leads to asana in the Raja Yoga tradition.
Oh, thank you so much for that. Listen,
we are going to take just a quick break and allow you to sit with, you the listeners and myself, to sit with what we have just learned. Thank you so much, Salvatore. And we're going to take a quick break and listen to an ad for the, well, it's not an ad, it's an upcoming symposium coming up for Tai Chi. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Restita De Jesus.
And I'm Robert Deal.
We're the founders of the Seika Network on blogtalkradio.com.
And we've got some great events that we'd like to share with you.
On July 6th through the 11th, 2014, the International Tai Chi Chuan Symposium will present an exciting event where five Tai Chi Grandmasters, each representing the traditional Chen, Yang, Wu Hao, Wu, and Sun styles of Tai Chi, will share their knowledge and skills. Tai Chi practitioners from all levels, including beginners, will benefit from this opportunity to learn and practice directly with the Grandmasters. The five masters that will be teaching at this event are Chen Zhenlei, Yang Jun, Zhang Zhenchan, Ma Hailong, and Sun Yongtian. You don't even have to be an experienced Tai Chi practitioner to attend. Whether you're a health promotion planner, healthcare provider, personal trainer, martial artist, physical education instructor, or school administrator, all are welcome to attend. Don't miss this opportunity to train directly under the masters. For more information to register for Directly from the Source, just go to www.taichisymposium.com or you can email info@taichisymposium.com.
That sounds like a good time. You had said maybe you'd be interested in going to that Tai Chi symposium. Yeah? Wouldn't I? Yeah. Okay. So, Salvatore, when we left, we were talking about Hatha Yoga, asana. We talked about how in the West it's being confused, or that yoga and asana are being confused as synonymous, and they are not. Asana being a part of yoga, yoga being something much larger, a much larger field, something that you said. How I had understood it, and many of my students coming to yoga understood the word yoga, is that it meant union. Can you elaborate on that? Is that in fact true?
Yes, it's true. But like so many other elements with yoga, it's part of a larger truth. And something that's hard to learn if you don't spend time with the old Indian teachers who are immersed in the ancient tradition and who really know Sanskrit. Now, I have some knowledge of Sanskrit, but I don't want to make too big of a deal about that. It's useful, and it's been good enough to write a dictionary with some skilled help. But this is where a lot of understanding can be found. So what I would start with some misunderstandings about the word asana before I go into yoga is it comes to mind that there's another confusion relative to asana which has to do with fitness. Yoga asana does not have a fitness concern. Yoga asana is designed to bring the body to sitting posture comfortably with the breath organized so that it can help bring the mind to a single point, which perhaps we can talk about a little bit later, either today or in another interview. The confusion here, when yoga asana is used as physical fitness, is that the correct word for that in Sanskrit would be vyayama. Vyayama. V-Y, long A, Y,